for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The title story of George Saunders' new collection of short fiction seems at first to be all about dying. But as with many of Saunders' stories, it's replete with surprises. Goodness and humor can almost always be found lurking in the darkness. Saunders exposes just how awful human beings can be without making us feel we live in an evil world. Awarding Saunders a genius grant, the MacArthur Foundation called him a sharply observant, highly imaginative author who's influencing a generation of young writers. His new book is titled 10th of December. George Saunders joins me in the studio. I hope you'll join the conversation as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Diane.
So glad to have you here. I'm fascinated with this first story, Victory Lap, because everything that's going on in this young person's mind, sort of he's talking to himself, but not really talking to himself. What he thinks he sees is a young girl who lives next door, somehow about to be attacked. He comes from a very, very strict home where absolutely everything he does has to be cataloged. I mean, even to the time and the way he walks into the house, whether he takes his boots off, whether he walks on the rug, he's cleaning up the rug afterwards. And I found myself feeling so sorry for this kid. What was your
childhood? That's perfectly reasonable parenting. No, that my childhood was the opposite. It was very free. But there, in our neighborhood, there was a family that had this system of major and minor treats. On each day of the week, for some reason, they were allowed certain treats if they'd behave well. So they became sort of a source of fun for us, because one of the younger kids who didn't know it was sort of embarrassing would say, "Ray, it's Tuesday. It's a major treat day." And the older kids would be petrified or, you know, mortified. But they all turned out really, really well. So I think part of this, for me, part of the fun of fiction writing is to try to inhabit somebody else's mind. And the weird thing is, you always have some aspect of that person in you. If you're imitating a 15-year-old girl, you can find her. If you're imitating a 97-year-old bitter ex-convict, you can find that person. So part of the craft for me is to, through many, many revisions, start out with a caricature of somebody, and then over the months start to feel them actually rising up from inside of me.
How about imitating someone who may be dying of cancer?
You know, that I just had the, I heard of someone who was in that situation. And, you know, David Mamet says that part the fictional impulse is partly related to daydreaming, that sort of spontaneous daydreaming that we do when we, you know, when we think of what we should have said or we imagine being at our own funeral. And when I heard about this protracted illness, I just got that feeling of recoil, like, oh, that I don't want that to happen to me. And then another micro burst of thought, which was, well, if it does, I'll get out of it. And then we really, how are you going to do that? And then I had this idea, I think I'd been reading Into Thin Air or maybe Jack London, this idea that if you go and freeze yourself to death, that's painless, which I'm sure is not really the case. But sometimes the ideas just come in those quick, literally like less than a second sort of mental projections that we do almost automatically.
And then what do you do with them? Do you write them down?
Sometimes, and that one I didn't. That one I just sat on it for about 6 or 7 months, and all it was what if? What if this? What if I decided to end my life that way? And it's interesting because that's where plot comes from, because once you say what if a guy tries to end his life, then your job is to kind of create obstructions, natural obstructions. So if he just does it, that's not a story. It's an anecdote. But if he goes to do it and is interrupted, suddenly then you get into some interesting turf.
How long did it take you to write that story?
That was about a year, maybe, not including the think time before.
Why do you think it takes you that long to write a story?
I think it's because part of the job of the writer is to sort of out yourself for your two simple ideas. You have an agenda at the beginning of the process. You want to pillory somebody, or you want to praise somebody, or you want to bring forth your smart political idea. If you just did that, you would be a great disappointment to your readers. That's lecturing. So sometimes to outsmart yourself, you have to put all your stuff down there and then feel your own discontent with it as you're rereading. Say, oh, God, if I was a reader, I'd really be feeling condescended to at this point. Then you come at it again and you start trying to deepen it. It's really a very interesting dialogue between you and you, which simulates the later dialogue between you and your reader.
You know, it's fascinating to me that the writer's imagination continues. Hmm. It seems to me for most of us who are not writers by nature or by training, that imaginative process comes to a quick halt. Hmm. And what you're describing is something that just keeps going.
Yeah, and you know, the method of reinvigoration, at least for me, is very intense engagement with the sentence-by-sentence progress of a story. So, for example, if, you know, often your first sentence will be kind of lame, placeholder. So, Bob was a big jerk. You know, that's not exactly Dickens. So you say, okay, well, what do you mean? You know, you say it to yourself very gently, could you give me a little more information?
Yeah.
So in the process, you'll get more information. You'll also get a better sentence. So if you say, okay, Bob snapped at the cashier and made her cry. Now we're kind of getting somewhere. And we say, that's too bad. That's too bad for Bob and the cashier. Why do you think he did that? And you say, well, then you revise. Bob snapped at the cashier whose way of brushing back her hair reminded him of his ex-wife or his deceased wife. And suddenly from being a jerk, Bob has gone to be kind of a deep well. He's somebody who's grieving enough to take it out on somebody else. And then, again, here comes plot, because now Bob has to come to grips with his grief or he's going to turn into really a bad guy.
So would you say you do that? You write sentence and then stop and then think about it, or does one follow another?
It's always different, but the thinking is the interesting part, because I try not to think about it as such. In other words, not to conceptualize or be logical, but it sounds kind of gauzy, but to have such a relationship to the sound of your own language that it constitutes of a different and deeper kind of thinking. You're not really thinking, well, I'm trying to make a point about patriarchy, but you're just trying to get the sentences to be zingy, you know? And as you do that, sometimes, you know, you'll take a kind of okay sentence, fairly leisurely, compress it, and find that rhythmically you've made a place at the end for something, and a noun will show up, and the noun is horse, and suddenly you've just made plot. So it's kind of a mysterious but really fascinating process.
Here's what I don't get. Prior to becoming a husband and father, you studied geophysics. You worked in the oil fields of Sumatra. So how did that lead to what you are and do now?
Well, I wasn't going to go to college at all. I had a career plan that included, you know, that, well, consisted entirely of playing in a band that was going to open for a band that would open for the band that would open for the Eagles. So that was a little sketchy. But then these two high school teachers, the Lindblums, kind of took me under their wings and got me into college. And it was at the School of Mines in Colorado, which is an engineering school. So at that point, my whole focus was just not to let them down and stay in school and try to get a degree. So after 4.5 years there, I got out, and only then I started to think, boy, I'm not good at this engineering. It's really a lot of work for me. There's no joy. It's all toil. But the only real fun I was having was up in the library. I'd read Thomas Wolfe or Hemingway. So I was kind of enough of a lunkhead not to make that connection. You know, if you love something, you might want to do it for a living. But I went to Asia and just started reading like crazy because we worked 4 weeks on and 2 weeks off.
I see.
And for those 4 weeks, we were in a really remote part of Sumatra with nothing to do. So you just load a bag up with books. And just sort of watching my own reaction to reading made me think, oh, this has got to be in my life somehow. I was came alive. I felt confident when I was reading. I felt opinionated and kind of certain. So then it was kind of a long, very uneven road. But I started writing in Asia really poorly, kind of all travel logs, but set in a matrix of there's an old guy in a nursing home, and he's remembering his youth, of course, in Asia, you know. But very gradually, it started to just be the dominant thing in my life, the most interesting, vital thing that there was.
And then after you came back here, you married,
mm-hmm.
you left the fields of Sumatra, then you began writing in earnest,
but not in quality. I had my wife and I met in grad school, and we had this crazy, wonderful 3-week courtship. I got engaged in 3 weeks, and then I was writing, but I by this time finished grad school, but still wasn't really doing anything. I was kind of a Hemingway imitator, basically. So the interesting thing is when you have that kind of interest in another writer, you get to a critical moment where there's no intersection between his diction and his mindset, his worldview, and the life you're actually living. So we were in Rochester, and I was working at a tech writer, and that was when things really started to happen. Humor started coming in, and the corporate world started coming in, and suddenly I had a little bit of an opinion about things.
George Saunders, his new book of short stories is titled 10th of December. We'll take a short break here and be right back. And if you've just joined us, George Saunders is with me. He's not only an author, his latest book of short stories being 10th of December, he's also the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, and he's a creative writing teacher at Syracuse University. George Saunders, would you read for us from that first story, Victory Lap? Set it up for us.
Sure. This is just a kind of internal monologue from the point of view of this 15-year-old girl. And I do a thing that I call a third-person ventriloquist, where it's kind of traditional stream of consciousness, except you're constrained by that person's diction and thought pattern. So you quickly go from sort of outside into her way of thinking and seeing. So here she's just waiting for her mother to pick her up for a ballet recital, and she's sort of just thinking about a few things that are important to her. So ixnay on the local boys. A special ixnay on Matt Dre, owner of the largest mouth in the land. Kissing him last night at the pep rally had been like kissing an underpass. Scary! Kissing Matt was like suddenly this cow in a sweater is bearing down on you, who will not take no for an answer, and his huge cowhead is being flooded by chemicals that are drowning out what little powers of reason Matt actually did have. What she liked was being in charge of her. Her body, her mind, her thoughts, her career, her future. That was what she liked. So be it. We might have a slight snack. Un petit repas. Was she special? Did she consider herself special? Oh, gosh, she didn't know. In the history of the world, many had been more special than her. Helen Keller had been awesome. Mother Teresa was amazing. Mrs. Roosevelt was quite chipper, in spite of her husband, who was handicapped, which, in addition, she had been gay, with those big old teeth. Long before such time as being gay and First Lady was even conceptual, she, Allison, could not hope to compete in the category of those ladies, not yet anyway.
And that is George Saunders reading from the first story in his book titled Victory Lap. And here's an email on that story from Andrew. He says, I think Mr. Saunders writes with a sort of literary voice recognizable as being of our time and is reminiscent of other contemporary writers, David Foster Wallace, or really anything that gets published in the New Yorker. It seems that when Mr. Saunders writes a story, there's still a meter and vocabulary which tells us it's not a 15-year-old girl or a high school boy, but that it's really Mr. Saunders writing the story. So my question is, says Andrew, to what extent does he feel he's in control of his own voice?
That's a deep one. I'll have the answer about 3:30 this morning.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right.
No, I think you are, I don't know about control, you're responsible for your own voice. You're responsible for what you call final. So in that sense, a writer is responsible for everything that happens in the field of the story, even if you're not entirely cognizant of it as you're doing it. In other words, you sort of have the right of final approval as you go through. So what I think I'm doing is I'm doing a very sort of wink and nod imitation of a 15-year-old girl that, as I said before, is sort of channeling up through yourself. And then, but in the end, the story is, it's funny, it's not really a mirror. It's not really an attempt to be real life. It's an object unto itself. And the real function of it is just sort of to be a place where the reader goes into this black box or this sort of area. Something happens that's non-trivial, meaningful, hopefully to the things that are really important to her in real time. And then she comes out the other side somehow energized. And for me, one of the hard challenges is to just leave it at that, to not be too programmatic or intentional, but just to say what I want to do is somehow in a non-random way give you a charge of energy and you know, come out the other side. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but...
But so many of these stories have these dark elements to them. And darkness is something that certainly teenagers live through, but it's not just teenagers.
No.
It's all of us.
No. I mean, at one level, you know, the darkness, you kind of do what you can do. You know, you might want to be a more lighthearted writer, but if it doesn't cohere, you don't really have a choice. So you sort of accept whatever offset you have to accept to get some traction going. If you think the idea, a story is sort of a scale model of life as you found it, say, maybe a distorted scale model. But for my part, the stories seem to work best when they're on a sort of catastrophic day or a difficult day, sort of an end condition day. And then my hope is to inject it with some kind of luminosity in the voice and the humor and maybe just the intensity of the experience. That's where the scale model sort of completes itself, I think.
Now, how much time do you spend teaching? How much time do you spend writing?
Well, I teach in the fall at Syracuse, 2 or 3 days a week. But really, you know, I'm about a 3 or 4 hour a day person writing, so I can fit that in almost anywhere. If I work more, I just start undoing the good I did in the morning. So 4 or 5 hours a day, even, but, you know, when I wrote my first book, I wrote it at work. So I had, you know, Shift F3 on the computer. So, and I put my desk the maximum number of steps away from the doorway. And I even perfected a sort of postural adjustment where I'd be working on my story all happy and vibrant. And then when someone came in, I'd hit Shift F3, slump and frown. And then, so really, that was great training because I can pretty much, if you give me 20 minutes, I can make a little bit of progress on something.
20 minutes.
Sure.
and you're happy with what you've done in that 20 minutes.
I can be. Maybe.
You know, somebody once said to me that you cannot teach someone to write creatively. The only thing you can do is to present that person with creative writing to read.
Right.
How do you feel about teaching creative writing?
Well, at Syracuse, we teach in a really strange, wonderful space because, for example, when I get home next week, we have 566 applications to read for 6 spots. So when these students come to us, they don't need to be taught to write at all. They're way ahead of that. The top 50, top 75 applications are amazing. So what we see ourselves as doing is trying to urge them up into that space where they're doing what only they can do, that kind of iconic place, which is quite psychological work. And it's kind of not in your hands. But what you try to say is, nobody wants to be a writer who's described as, oh, fine, you know, oh, she's quite interesting. Everyone who starts this, or probably any art, wants to be wonderful, you know, and beloved. So how do you get someone from very, very, very good to beloved? It's difficult, but,
How much is it the quality of writing, and how much is it the depth to which you understand yourself?
I think it's the second, because at that level, the quality of writing is already there. So it's also, I sometimes have called it a talent for having talent. All these people have talent. Now, then you're up on sort of the last 15 feet of the mountain, but there's a lot of deep pits there and a lot of walls. So the thing is, how do you negotiate that very last step? And it is very much about being in relation to your own talent, being comfortable with progress, for example. Very, very interesting work.
Talk about your family, your wife, your children.
Mm-hmm. Paul and I must have met in grad school, and we've been married 25, almost 26 years. And it's just been such an amazing blessing. I think when I was young, I didn't hear enough about the wonders of a long marriage. You know, I saw too many sitcoms or something, but the extent to which that's a deep spiritual ongoing support for everything that you do. I had no idea when I was younger. So
how did you meet?
We met at the Syracuse graduate program.
And in 3 weeks.
In 3 weeks, yeah. And it was just, it was one of those things. I mean, if you believe that notion of completion, a person completing someone, she absolutely did. There were places I could not have gone in my life unless I'd had her to go ahead and lead me. And mostly it was, getting true emotion into my work, not just being clever, not mm-hmm. being silly, but really stepping up to the big issues. And just a constant source of urging me to be my best self and accepting me when I wasn't. That was the thing I couldn't have anticipated. The times, the notion that someone could know you so well, know everything about you, even the things you would like to keep hidden, and still accept you, that's an incredibly empowering, wonderful thing.
Children.
We have 2 daughters, 24 and 22. To say, that they're the light of your life is to understate it. Just to see these wonderful people and be able to influence them and be influenced by them is terrific.
How did being a parent influence your writing?
It was night and day. Before that, I think I was pretty good. I mean, clever, smart enough, but I didn't really see the universe as being morally infused. I was a pretty good person, but maybe out of habit. I was raised Catholic, and I just, But after the kids were born, I had that revelation that, everybody is somebody's kid, and everybody should be as beloved as these kids are. Maybe everyone isn't. But then I just found that suddenly morality was everywhere. Even the smallest decision, if it affected another human being, came home right away to me. To have these 2 daughters and think, wait a minute, there's a whole world out there that can either be kind or cruel, and actually we are the instruments by which that occurs. So it was really overnight, and suddenly then the work started getting better, I think, because there was nothing trivial. There, you didn't have to have a huge drama. Even if there were 2 human beings sitting in a room and one was slightly hurting the feelings of the other, that would be sufficient drama if the person being hurt was your beloved.
I'm interested in how you reacted when you heard you were going to be the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award.
Well, I disagreed with the diagnosis, but I was happy for the award.
Tell me how it came.
Well, I was doing a story for GQ. I did a series of nonfiction pieces for them, and this one was to drive the whole Mexican border from Brownsville to San Diego. And this day, I'd been out in the field with those Minutemen, the kind of militia guys. So we stayed up all night. They were armed to the teeth, really, you know, exciting and stressful.
What year is this?
I think 2005 or six,
okay.
Somewhere there. So I came back to the hotel kind of just, you know, elated and wired. And then I got an email from my wife saying, honey, call me. And then the next email was from MacArthur saying, Mr. Sonner, did you contact us? So it was, but it was late. It was 3 a.m. So I can't do this. So I thought, I wonder, you know, could it be?
Could it be?
But, you know, sometimes you get asked for recommendations. So I went to sleep and had a really telling dream, which is I dreamed that a nun came to me in that hotel, and she said, oh, so you think you're getting the MacArthur, do you, Mr. Saunders? Aren't you clever? Do you really, you know, that kind of thing. Thank you, internal psychology. And then, so the next morning, I called the gentleman, and he was completely nice and just said, are you sitting down? And you'll never hear from us again. And that's the way they do it. It's an incredible organization. Such generosity.
And you never hear from them again.
No.
You get a check in the mail. Do you pay taxes on that?
You do. That's the only part I really didn't like.
They pay them?
No. You pay them. Yeah. But, you know, it was interesting because it raised the ceiling in all ways. Financially and psychologically, you suddenly feel bold.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, we're going to open the phones here, 800-433-8850. First to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, James.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane. Good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead, sir.
I wanted to know, George, about, you know, your process as far as a writer. How do you keep your stories in your mind? I know that it doesn't get written overnight. And, how do you keep that fresh and able to return to
it? Yeah, that's it. I'm guessing you're a writer, James.
Well, I try.
Yeah. No, it's funny. It's a great question. And I think for me, what you do is you don't keep it in your mind. And I think Hemingway says something like this, like, don't just leave it behind and let your subconscious chew on it. And I think he advised never think about your stories when you're not in the middle of them.
But you've got to trust yourself.
You have to trust, and what you have to trust specifically is your day-to-day or minute-to-minute reaction to your own text as you're rereading it. And the idea is to do that in a state where you're not attached to what you did yesterday. So you're really trying to simulate a first-time reader, which is impossible, but you can kind of simulate it. So what I imagine that you have a kind of a meter in your head with positive on one side and negative on the other. And as you're reading, that needle is moving. And if you're quiet enough, you can see it. So if you're reading a section and it's up in the positive, you're doing pretty well. And then there on page 4, suddenly it goes bleh, and it drops down. But that's good news. That means your taste is asserting itself and you kind of know where to start. So to me, the trick is to say, I'm not going to think about it when I'm away from it. I'm not going to have a whole lot of ideas of what I'm doing, because doing that will stop you from getting the signal back from the story in real time. If it says, I'm flagging here, can you please do something? Your job is to hear that and then, you know, react accordingly.
Does that help, James?
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. That's great advice.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling to Houston, Texas. Good morning, John.
Good morning. This is my pleasure to be here. My son is a junior in high school, and he has wonderful ideas on fantasy of planets with various living objects. But he struggles to write it down. And I'd like to have your advice on helping him potentiate that to the page.
Sure.
Thanks.
Well, I mean, one possibly cheesy idea is they have this, you know, this software now where you can just talk it. And that, you know, that's not a bad way to get a first draft. Have him just talk, and you can even ask him questions and engage with him. And then at the end, there'll be some text that'll be available for him to work with. Linda Berry is a wonderful writer and teacher, and she talks about when she was trying to write her first book, she was getting blocked with the typing. She'd see the typing, and it would make her unhappy what she had written. So because she's a visual artist, she actually wrote her entire first draft on calligraphy paper, beautiful calligraphy paper with calligraphy pens, maybe 3 or 4 lines on pages. And she'd just take those and put them down. And in the end, she had this towering stack of pages. And by then, she was 80 or 90 real pages in. And so I think part of the game is to be real kind with yourself and say, look, writing is weird, it's hard. We're going to do it by any means necessary, and we're going to, you know, kind of work with your own psychology. If you have an obstruction, it doesn't mean that you're a bad person or you're a bad writer. It just means that's a feature of your process.
Is that what you say to your students?
Yes, of course. Whatever, you know, it's whatever they bring, especially at that level, whatever they bring is an interesting data point.
Give me an example.
Okay, so one of the things that good writers tend to do is they do what I call avoidance. You've got a story, you're on draft 97, and it's really getting hot, and you're really getting to the emotional core. But your subconscious is not entirely happy. It doesn't know, it has a lack of confidence. It's not sure that it can execute. So often what will happen is they'll put in a spaceship, or there'll be a strange flashback, or the diction will suddenly take some weird turn. So part of what we do is just identify the avoidance and ask them to come back to it.
George Saunders, his new book of short stories is titled 10th of December. Short break and right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy pajamas delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com. From Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future One Opportunity at a Time. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Scott Shane, a New York Times national security correspondent, talks about breaking drone-related stories, including the revelation that President Obama personally approves the names on the targeted assassination list. Join us.
And before we go back to the phones, let's have you read from another story. Tell us which one.
Well, this is a long story called The Semplica Girl Diaries, and it's in the form of a diary, so you'll hear the kind of truncated diction.
And what does Semplica mean?
Well, it's I'm afraid to give it away, but Semplica Girl is a certain kind of, it's kind of a lawn ornament made out of third world women. I just gave it away. There we go.
Okay.
But yeah, but that's not, this is just sort of a set piece from in there in this diary voice.
All right.
October 1st, Todd Grassberger funeral today at Ukrainian church downtown. Todd, apparently from humble roots. Priest equal long-haired guy in cassock. Sings chants whole service in Ukrainian from memory. As he chants, paces, cassock rope swings. Scary guy. Very intense. Sermon. Why this surprising? Did you think you were going to live forever? Only difference between you sitting there anticipating the rest of your day and Todd in coffin, bound for eternal home in cold earth, is heartbeat. Feel that, people? In your chests? That is thin line between you and grave. So why do you live like you are eternal? That foolish, you are fools. This scary, this not scary, this truth, this reality. Shouts, shall we wake up? Shall we? Everyone staring big-eyed at priest. except usual congregants who seem to have heard all before. Priest goes on, "Which of us will die tonight? Do we think he's being facetious? That shows we are dopes. Any one of us could die tonight, die right now, suddenly come up short of breath, keel over in pew, be with Todd and Earth in wink of eye." Suddenly from downstairs kitchen, smell of roast beef. Happy chatter from church ladies down in kitchen. Smell of roast beef plus sound of pots clinking, plates being set out equal appealing. People shifting in pews due to amazing smell of beef.
I can see that priest. I can smell that roast beef. It's wonderful.
That's good. Thank you. Based wonderful. On a true story.
All right. Let's go to Sarasota, Florida. Hi there, Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so happy. I'm in the middle of the book, and I just finished Semplica Girls.
Yeah.
And I was so curious about them as I was reading the story and then finally figured out what they were. But I don't know what they represent. I want to know the idea of it.
You've got the right idea, which is we don't know. No, I'll tell you the story. This was a 12-year story. It's not that long, but it took me 12 years. And I'd had a dream. I woke up when our kids were little. I woke up and walked to a non-existent window in our bedroom that let me see out onto the backyard. And in the backyard, there was a beautiful fall night, and there was a string of, there were four women that I understood in the dream to be from, disadvantaged countries in the third world. And they were hanging on this weird wire that went right through their heads, in one side, out the other, on a kind of a swing set thing. And they had each of them had long black hair, and the strange thing about the dream, and the reason I went on to write it, was the reaction was not "Oh my God, call 911," but "Oh, I'm so lucky, we finally made it. I'm so glad that I can do this for my family." So I woke up from that, and you know, you'll often have dreams that are just silly that aren't writable, but that one really stuck with me. So your question is right on the money. For all those 12 years, I was trying to figure out what do those mean. Now, on one level, they mean something very simple, which is oppression of the third world.
Exactly.
Right. But if that's the problem was, that's for many drafts, that's all it meant. And that's not good enough. You know, there's that.
But that string holding those girls mm-hmm. together, I kept wondering, what does SG stand for? What
right.
does SG stand for? Who are these people? How did they get this way? Why did they consent to be...
Right.
Right. This way.
Well, that was one of the challenges of a story like this is that I want to stay in his mind. So he never really would, in his diary, turn to the camera and talk at length about this thing that is second nature in his world. So part of it was just to seed those hints in there. And I probably have 500 pages of drafts, so I know all the backstory. And then the trick is to just put a little hint of why they're there, a little hint of the process by which they consented and why. So it's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of kind of lapidary work where you're taking a sentence out and putting a sentence in and so
Susan,
on.
Susan, does that help?
It does help. And one more thing. I'm glad that I'm not done with the book.
I am too, because it's going to be another 8 years before the next one.
there's more.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
And
thanks.
Thank you for calling.
But this is part of the point is when you're writing, you know, you have an initial idea, and as you complicate it takes you into places that you could never have expected. And that always is kind of a deepening.
But that was shocking.
Yeah.
It was a shocking
story.
For me, too,
as I did it. You know, but you get used to it, and then, you know, what you're trying to do is get the story to be about that one thing and then surprise you by being about something else, which in this one was sort of that contrasted with the familial warmth. That was a strange juxtaposition
exactly.
I didn't expect.
The father trying to do something
right.
for his daughter. Let's go to West Tisbury, Massachusetts. Billy, you're on the air.
Hi. Wow, it's a pleasure to get through and speak to Mr. Saunders.
Hi, Billy.
And a couple years ago, I read a story, I think it was either a story or a personal history piece in The New Yorker about you, I believe it was you, it was autobiographical, growing up in Chicago and working, you know, these jobs and...
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in the story, you talked about, I decided to stop losing. And then you know, time went by, and then I really decided to stop reading. And it just really struck me, and I have this posted up in my studio, and just the self-defeating nature of creative types or, you know, these sort of pitfalls that we create for ourselves.
Yeah. Well,
I like that word.
Yeah,
that's tickles.
It's a great, yeah, it's a great. Well, I was kind of just in my 20s, I had been to Asia and gave up that job, and then sort of just started stumbling. And every so often I'd say, okay, that's enough. Now it's time to sit up and, you know, and get it right. And then it would happen again. And so I was a roofer during that period and worked at a convenience store and was a doorman in Beverly Hills. And at some point while I was a roofer, I thought, okay, that enough. I'm too old for this. And then still couldn't, you know, get on my feet. So it was actually a great, in retrospect, a great, you know, look into sort of money and the stresses that makes in American life and that kind of thing.
And one person, a Twitter question, why the 10th of December? This person is curious because he or she says, it's my deceased father's birthday.
I just really like the sound of it. When I was a young writer, I would do things like you name somebody, you know, Fred Arrogance as a clue, or, you know, try to make a really fraught title. But now I'm kind of always trying to avoid a title that conveys too much metaphorical meaning. And I just love the sound of, I tried other ones and I just really love the sound of the words.
Now I'm going to take you somewhere else because you said in an interview that you used to be kind of an Ayn Rand guy.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, when I was in high school and I was making the decision whether to be with the, you know, the Eagles opening act or to be, go to college, I was reading Atlas Shrugged. And I hadn't read a novel maybe since third grade. You know, I read Johnny Tremaine. And the book really moved me, maybe because I was starting to get the feeling that the ship of success was leaving the port. I was a bad high school student, was having trouble getting to school. And something about that mindset really excited me, you know, that if you are in fact the center of the universe. There's a vast hidden machine that's manipulating everything, and somehow it excited that kind of juvenile boy in me that felt slightly left behind. But also, it was a novel, and even though I think now it's not, in my view, it's not a very artistic novel, it inspired in me this vision of cheesy vision of walking across a college campus in what I think I thought of as a college sweater, you know, a big, like sort of in the old Ronald Reagan movies, and just having a group of friends and having an intellectual discussion. So for me at that point, she was sort of like an Eastern European intellectual. I'd never heard any of these ideas. And so was very intrigued. And that book had a lot to do with me deciding to go to college. So then fast forward, I went to Asia and saw, you know, so much suffering. And unlike in the Ayn Rand books, these were people who weren't whiners or weren't trying to game the system. They were people working harder than anyone had ever seen. And still, you know, I remember seeing in a building foundation about 200 elderly women who were there at night to clear the site of rubble and so on. So even kind of a dullard like me could see that and go, wait a minute, those people are not, you know, they actually are victims. They're not whiners. They're not trying to pull a fast one. So in time it was corrected.
But. So how did that then make you feel about what you had read of her?
You know, I haven't gone back and read her, and I'm not sure that she is. I mean, I know a lot of people have taken those ideas and done terrible things with them, and I think she was coming from the Soviet Union, so who knows what her real thoughts were. But I know the what I don't like is the mindset that says if you have something, you got it 100% through virtue by yourself, and therefore it's okay for you to be slightly dismissive of people who don't have things. That seems to me anti-democratic. It's not really, it doesn't seem like the most generous vision of capitalism. So that part of it, whether it's her idea or her misunderstanding, it turns my stomach a little bit.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Your show is incredible and my favorite author in the whole world.
Oh, thank you.
So, George, ever since Civil War, Land and Decline came out, 20 years ago now?
Yeah, 96.
Yeah. I've been giving it to my coworkers and colleagues in community development. We all work in struggling neighborhoods and in struggling cities. And I've always found it just a great antidote for all the efforts we all make for placemaking and building up our communities and kind of chamber of commerce boosterism at times. So thank you for
that. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You brought us back down to earth. And I apologize if I missed this earlier before I tuned in, but I've also heard the story several times on NPR about your role in inspiring the Geico caveman ad. So, you know, whether it's civic boosterism or it's marketing, how do you feel when you're very honest and tragic message about marketing goes wrong gets turned back around into marketing?
Yeah. Well, I have a deal with Geico that I'm allowed to write a novel about a green lizard. So it's kind of a reciprocity thing. No, you know, really, I it's interesting because I'm starting to think, I won't be able to articulate this, but the way that we make a difference in the world, the way that we affect the world, is often really more complicated than we can imagine. You put a book out, and it goes out into, hopefully, into people's heads. And I'm not sure you can control that. I think I've had certainly times where I've put a book out, and I had a story out once where somebody completely misread it and used it as an excuse to put their mother into a nursing home before she needed to go. So you know, I mean, one of the things writers do is we have a shtick about art doing all these wonderful things, but it's interesting. You really can't quite be sure. So you can control your part of it, but you never know what's going to happen on the other end.
Thanks for calling, Tom, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm show. Here's an email. Does Mr. Saunders meditate? I saw a photograph of his home. Many Buddha statues line the drive.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I are both practitioners in the Buddhist Nyingma tradition. And but I'm such a beginner that the one thing I know is that I shouldn't, you know, I'd be hesitant to talk about Buddhism as such. But you know, for me, ever since I was a kid, the spiritual life was very interesting. I remember when we were kids in the Catholic Church, they would have the Stations of the Cross. And the way we did it old school, Chicago style, it was 17 hours long or something. But part of it was you would sit, and then the priest would describe the image, and then the nun would encourage you to imagine, what is Jesus thinking here? What is the bystander thinking? And then, this is pretty radical, what do you think that centurion is thinking? Why is he here? You know, and that got really in deep, that kind of projective. It's basically fiction writing. And the animating principle is that the idea that you actually can empathize with somebody else, and you can do it through language. And when you do it, it expands your worldview.
So your worldview is now through something different, something that was other.
Right.
When you were growing up.
Right. But I think the whole process of saying it would be really strange if our habitual way of thinking about the world and understanding it was exactly the right size to understand the universe as it really is. That would be a real weird coincidence if we were the first generation. So this seed of curiosity that got planted as a young man, where these adults you respected would say, just because you think it's so doesn't mean it's so. There's mysteries beyond what you can imagine. That gets into you, I think, and in my case, it's found expression through art for sure. That's and certainly in these other spiritual.
One quick question and email from Ron in Detroit. Can you say something about the genesis of the story, Escape from Spiderhead?
Sure. I was thinking ever since I was a little kid, I was kind of interested in the idea that what you think of as yourself, your personality, your character, can be altered by something very small, like a flu, you know, or some good news, or falling in love. That always made me wonder, well, how fixed and central am I if I can get a virus and be totally grouchy? You know, suddenly everything in the house looks terrible, everyone's terrible. So I had that thought for many, many years. How would we get that into a story? And then at one point I'd written a few stories where the diction was purposely a little dampened, a little suppressed and minimalist. And I was just getting a little restless. I wanted to write it in a higher register. So these ideas came together and I was writing in that low register. And I thought, oh God, I'm sick of this. How can I make an excuse to try to imitate Henry James? And I just thought, oh, he takes a drug. What kind of drug? Well, an articulate drug. So he took this drug called that I called Verbaloose, and suddenly then you can go in a couple paragraphs from low to high, and it was just, you know, and then from there, the story just sort of laid itself out with the series of drugs that he was given.
Well, clearly, people have enjoyed hearing you. They certainly enjoy reading your work. I hope you continue to write for a long time.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Have you got another book in the works?
I've got some pages in the works.
Excellent. George Saunders, his latest book of short stories titled 10th of December. I assure you, worth reading. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yorv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.